being held captive by a large venomous snake and nearly suffocating in quicksand. After hitching overland from Europe, he was initially rejected at the Indian border for being another useless beggar. But a promise to a border guard sent him on his way. 40 years later, Radhanath Swami is one of India's premier spiritual leaders. He has communed with spiritual leaders such as the Dalai Lama and lived and worked with others, including Mother Teresa. His public appearances draw thousands of followers, and he was recently invited for a private audience with the President of India. Loyal supporters donate millions of dollars each year, all of which are used to head up some of the most highly regarded community service projects. From the formation of a massive distribution center for indigent children, to emergency relief programs, to the creation of an orphanage, an eye clinic, and a hospital, his contributions to India are so vast, they have earned him celebrity-like status. And yet, Radhanath Swami's life is anything but glamorous. As a Swami, or a monk exclusively dedicated to God's services, he has taken vows of poverty, celibacy, and abstinence from intoxicants. He has no property, no bank account, and not a penny to his name. But he has found the one thing so many strive to achieve, the path to enlightenment. Radhanath Swami travels in Asia, Europe, and America, teaching devotional wisdom and conducting seminars in top universities and corporations on varied topics, like leadership, stress management, relationship management, and yoga. The Journey Home is an extraordinary memoir in which the author weaves a colorful tapestry of adventure, mysticism, and love. He teaches us that it is not important if you are a Hindu, a Muslim, a Christian, or a Jew, but whether or not you can love yourself and every living being. As one reviewer said about his book, this book is a profound story of Radhanath Swami's journey from the material world of temptation, attachment, several difficulties to the innermost innocent and spiritual awakening. Welcome, Radhanath Swami.
Said, but I'm very grateful to you. वंशकल्पाथरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिन्धुभ्य एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः हे कृष्णा करुणा सिन्धु दीनाबंधो जगत्पते गोपेशा गोपिका खंडा राधा खंडा नमोस्तुते तप्त कंचन गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानु सुधे देवे प्रणमामि हरि प्रिय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासदि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे
I think this is the most wonderful bookstore I've ever seen.
so grateful and so honored to have this opportunity to be with all of my friends. You're the one that dragged me on stage then. Shiva, yes. I'm so grateful to all of you for coming. I'm just remembering here in the Bodhi Tree bookstore 39 years ago, when I was sitting from sunrise to sunset every day under the original Bodhi tree. Have any of you been there before? There's a very holy place in India, in the Bihar state, named Gaya, which has been a place of pilgrimage for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And just in the outskirts of Gaya, Lord Buddha sat under a peepal tree and was determined he would not get up until he attained enlightenment. And there he was tempted in every possible way, but he remained committed to his goal in life. And that is where the Buddha attained enlightenment. And from there he went to the Deer Park in Sarnath, where he met his old classmates in asceticism, and he began the Buddha path. I remember, could everyone hear me?
No.
Can you hear me now? I remember when I was sitting under that Bodhi tree, meditating on Buddha, how he was a prince with royal luxuries. All he had to do was just keep living and he would have been the king. He didn't have to do anything else but breathe, and he would have been the king of a massive empire. But he saw the sufferings of old age, of disease, of death, of the anxiety of the mind and the body, and anxieties caused by other living beings, and anxieties caused by natural disturbances. And he wanted to find a happiness that could not be marred by all of these things. So he left the royal luxuries of his palace, seeking inner wealth, which culminated under the Bodhi tree, where he found that inner wealth. And after that, even the greatest kings would come to him, asking him for his wealth. Not material wealth, but spiritual wealth. And a boy coming from the northern suburbs of Chicago, where I was born and raised, to think that material things would bring real happiness. To meditate on the life of Buddha was very much a shift in priorities. He had everything and he was looking for something else. What are we really looking for? So this book, The Journey Home, is a story which talks about one little person's search for that inner fulfillment. I'll be honest with you, I never wanted to write this book. In fact, from the time of this journey, on occasions I would share some stories with people, and over a course of 30 years, so many people were asking me, you should write a book. And my answer was always the same, I will never write a book. And I had two reasons why I did not want to write a book about this. One is I was thinking in my heart that it's an act of arrogance to write a book about myself, where every page will be filled with I, me, and mine words. And second of all, I was thinking if I actually wrote what really happened, I don't think anybody will believe it's true. So I crossed that out of my options in life until something happened that changed my mind. May I share it with you? One of my very dearest friends, his name was Bhakti Tirtha Swami. I'd like to go a little into his background. Very special person. He was born the same year as me in 1950. He was African American. He was born in the ghettos of Cleveland, Ohio. And during the 50s and 60s, if you were of that descent, born in a ghetto, it was almost for sure hopeless that you would live the rest of your life and die in the ghetto. There was very little equal opportunity. Although the Constitution gives rights, for all practical purposes, serious prejudice. I remember when I was 16, I worked a job for myself and my friend Gary. We worked, and everybody with us were African Americans from the south side of Chicago. And we saw how they suffered. And it deeply affected my heart. Why? Bhakti Tirtha Swami, he was just such a compassionate person who was so absolutely positive, even as a child. He had a disease called stammering. Not a disease, but he stammered. Every time he tried to talk in public, he'd go like that. But whenever he would talk about spiritual subjects, he could speak nicely. His brothers and sisters, they've told me this. But because of his kindness, his positiveness, his hopefulness, and his endeavors, he got a full scholarship and graduated from Princeton University. He was a civil rights leader at Princeton in that part of the country. But he was looking for something even greater than that. And he turned to spirituality and became a world spiritual teacher. Tens and thousands of followers, about 20 books he wrote. Some of the people who would take advice from him were Nelson Mandela, Muhammad Ali, and Alice Coltrane. In about, I think it was 2005, he called me to his bedside in rural Pennsylvania. He was dying of melanoma cancer. He called me and said, I think I only have 3 days more to live. Please come. So I came. And I had a lot of pressing appointments. So I stayed with him a day and a half. And I was about to tell him that I had to leave. But before I could say anything, he said, please stay with me, I want to die in your arms. So I canceled everything. And he lived another 8 weeks. But I can honestly say that I've never had a friendship with deeper intimacy and love than during those 8 weeks. Because we focused exclusively on inspiring and enlightening each other spiritually. And when a spiritual purpose, or when God is in the center between us, how it can bring our souls together. We really became one in our affection, in our love, in our care for each other, for the body, the mind, and the soul. It was actually incredible. What a relation can do when there's no selfishness, but we're genuinely trying to share the gift of love for God with each other. One example, one day I came into his room, and he couldn't walk because he was emaciated, he had tumors all over his body, he was paralyzed from the waist down. So there was a bag where his urine was going, and it was red. They said he had blood in his urine. So we spoke for a couple hours that day, and just at the end of our talk, he said to me, with such feeling, he said, "I can't tell you how much it means to me that you're with me at this time in my life." He said, it really feels like you're going through everything I'm going through with me. And to have a brother or a sister that's going through these challenges with me gives so much meaning to it. I said, "Maharaj, I said, I really am going through this with you." Now, I didn't know what I was saying until I came to the house I was staying at. And I lifted the seat of the toilet to pass urine, and it was bright red. Now, I eat beets every day, and it's never happened like that. It actually, our hearts were so much together that what he was going through really was. And the day that he departed from the world, I was as sick as he was. Somehow or other, I'm still around though. The physical is very much a manifestation of the mental state. And the mental state is very much affected by our spiritual state. One day when I was with him, he was in so much pain. His whole body was trembling because of the pain. And usually we would discuss spiritual subjects. There was one verse of a great saintly person, of one particular prayer that he was singing when he was in the last days of his life. And we would read that prayer together and then speak on that prayer for several hours every day. We would go in all kinds of directions, but it was focused on that prayer. But this day, I could see he couldn't concentrate. The pain was so intense. So I just started to chant like Kamini and Keshava Prabhu. I was just, and he started singing with me. And suddenly, the most blissful smile manifested on his face. He was practically smiling from one ear to the other. And his eyes were glistening in joy, and tears of ecstasy were flowing from his eyes. And he shook his head. And he said, "It doesn't get any better than this." Now his body was still shaking from the pain. That didn't change. He said, "I would not change my position for anyone else in the world, because today I am tasting the sweetness of God's name like I've never tasted before." He said, whatever I'm going through is just a token small price for this experience I'm feeling within. This was Bhakti Tirthaswami. Just giving himself to others completely. Even when people would come to give him some encouragement, and it would end up that he would console them and solve all their problems, and they would go out very happy people. Almost every person that came out of his room would be weeping. They were touched so deeply. And one time there was a room full of about 25 people, and they all came out weeping. Lives changed. And I said to him, how did you do that? I've known you for 35 years. I've never seen you do this to people. And he said, you see this disease? He said, this is facilitating me to serve people in a much deeper way. He said, I'm grateful to have that. One day, he looked at me. He was laying in his bed and I was sitting at his side. And he said, Swamiji, you should write this book about your travels. And I said, I will not write this book. And he said, why? And I explained all the reasons I just told you. He said, get out of your illusion. He said, this is not your story. This is God's story. About how God took a young man on a journey in search of what everyone is looking for in this world, in one way or another. In search of inner fulfillment, inner meaning in life. And how he put you through so many extraordinary experiences to find that. He said, if your story will give hope or inspiration to anyone, then it is an act of arrogance for you not to write it. In fact, you are arrogant and miserly. And then he looked up at me with very innocent, childlike eyes and took my hand and squeezed it and said, promise me on my deathbed that you will write and publish this book. What would you do?
I want to do that.
Special effects. I almost right at the climax. So I promised him. But then over the next few days, I was thinking of ways to convince him to retract the promise. But then he left. He passed away with several hundred people at his bedside, singing kirtan, the holy names, weeping tears of prayers of love for him, helping to make him. He didn't need help, but it was just an act of love for everyone to come together, to be chanting and praying as his soul departed from his body. It is the story of a young boy born in Chicago, brought up about 30 miles north in a small town, who spent teenage years in the 1960s. It was a time of great transition in America. There was literally a war between two generations. Counterculture and their parents. There was a Vietnam War. And now people are very disturbed about the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War. But in those days, there was a draft. And every single man, unless you had some way out, which I didn't, when you turned 18, you were eligible for the draft. And if you were drafted, you had three choices. Go and fight and kill or be killed for something you do not believe in, or go to jail and have your name blacklisted for the rest of your life, or illegally escape the country. Those were the three choices. That's the way it was presented to us. So this brought about a very, very personal concern about this war. I remember in the Grand Park of Chicago, I think it was 1968, I was in a peaceful demonstration to question whether we should be in Vietnam. And I was tear gassed and chased by club swinging police who I was told were protecting my freedom. And seeing the plight of the African American people, I was part of Martin Luther King's civil rights movement. And I remember in the South, I was marching, and there were bottles and stones and curse words hurled at me by my white brothers and sisters. I believe it was Martin Luther King who said, if you do not have an ideal that you're willing to die for, you don't really have anything meaningful to live for. And I yearned to find that ideal in my life. And I read Gandhiji, Mahatma Gandhi, because I saw so many problems within the world, so many things that I just didn't think was right. And he said, we should be the change that we want to see in the world. We should be the change that we want to see in others. Things like this, and some of the music of the 60s, and my own explorations, gradually led me on a spiritual path. Myself and my very dearest friend in life, we grew up from our maybe 7 or 8 years old. We became really good friends in high school because we had a lot that we shared. One day, this friend named Gary, who by the way now lives in Malibu Beach, he called me and he said, we are going on a trip to Europe, you must come with us. I said, I have no money. How am I going to go? I have a job set up this summer. This is 19 years old. He said, I don't have any money either, but Frank is going to sponsor both of us. So I said, all right, I'll go. So Frank sponsored both of us, and we got a $65 flight, I think it was that much, from New York to Iceland. And then it went on to Luxembourg. And the first night we stayed in a camping ground in a tent. First night. We woke up the next morning. You can't imagine how happy we were. For the first time in our lives, we were in another country, a foreign land, without any supervision. We were totally free. As I was savoring the fresh air and the prospect of what was ahead of us, I heard this shriek, And out from the tent came Frank, who told us he had been robbed of all of his money. All he had left was his return flight. And he said, come, we have to all go because there's no money left. And Gary and I looked at each other. And we said goodbye to Frank. Couldn't believe it. Even we couldn't believe it. I remember sitting at a little stream, looking at the water flowing, thinking, now I'm as free as this stream. Wherever destiny takes me, I'm ready to go. And Gary and I, we were on a spiritual search. First, we were associating with the counterculture in Amsterdam and London and other places. We went to the Isle of Wight Rock Festival. And I remember the music was playing. It was so loud. It was the biggest rock festival of our whole generation, much bigger than Woodstock even, the Isle of Wight. And every big band in the West was there. And as the amplifiers were pounding out this music, it seemed like the scattering the cloud, shaking the mountains and stirring the sea. But there was something much louder happening in my heart. There was this silent call that was so loud I couldn't even hear the music, calling me away from it all. I started going to monasteries, synagogues, cathedrals. Gary and I would spend whole days in art museums trying to find spiritual symbolism in art. Trying to find ourselves, trying to find a higher connection. And eventually it led us through Italy, through Greece, where we were on the Isle of Crete, and we lived in a cave together. And I would climb a mountain, and from sunrise to sunset, I would meditate, read spiritual books, and pray. And Gary was doing the same thing on the seashore. After some weeks, the intensity of my thirst for spiritual experience became so overwhelming. What began as a small spark was now a blazing fire, which burned away and evaporated my aspiration for anything else. And I remember that day crying for direction, because I really didn't know which way to go. Right as the sun was setting, I heard a voice from within, a silent voice that was so loud that it changed my life. I knew if I followed this calling, I would never be the same. That voice spoke three words. Go to India. I never met an Indian. I never had Indian food. I didn't know where India was. I had no money, and I didn't even have a map. But I was determined to go. I went back to the cave where Gary was sitting in meditation. He looked at me, and he said, something amazing happened today. I said, what? Gary said, at sunset, I heard a voice. I said, what did he say? Gary said, you won't believe me. I said, I might. He said, no, you won't believe me. I said, no, I really might. He said, this voice told me, go to Israel. I said, where? He said, I told you you wouldn't believe me. I said, no, I believe you, but where? I sat closer to him.
He said, Israel. I said, Gary, he told me to go to India. India! Gary yelped. There was complete silence for at least 20 minutes. And I remember looking up at the stars over the Mediterranean Sea, and I whispered something to God in the heavens. I said, I'm willing to go. And I told Gary, at sunrise tomorrow, I'm leaving for India. He said, hitchhiking through the Middle East is not the same as hitchhiking through Europe. It's very dangerous. These are desert countries. He tried to talk me out of it. And I considered what he said. But this calling was so strong, I couldn't delay. And the next morning I left him, stranded alone on a Greek island as I was hitchhiking to India. And it takes me through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and ultimately into India, where I went to the Himalayas. There met many very famous people, some who are unheard of by the world. What was interesting is I was just 19, just turning 20. The first day I arrived in the Himalayas, I was sitting on the banks of the Ganges River for hours, just so happy to be there, all alone. When I saw a holy man come out of the forest, his complexion was golden, dark gold. He had long gray beard and hair. And he was walking toward me with his face down toward the sand. And his spiritual robes were flowing in a river breeze. He walked right up to me and I stood up to greet him. And he said, I know who you are, but you do not know me. Now take off your Western clothes and throw them in the River Ganges. Now I only had one set of clothes. And I really liked them too. They were gray jeans with black stripes going up and down. And I had a gray turtleneck shirt with stripes going across. thin stripes. And I took them off and threw them. And he said, I will give you the robes of a sadhu. I asked, what is a sadhu? He said, a sadhu is one who forsakes the material world to seek the divine. Or you may say, a monk, a homeless wanderer. So I took off my pants and my shirt and threw them in the Ganges. The rapid current swept them away forever. Then he gave me a simple sheet of white cloth that I wrapped around my waist and another one that I wrapped around the top part of my body. And then he told me I had to throw my underwear in. So I did it, and he gave me two strips and showed me how to make a loincloth, two strips of cloth. And then he said one more thing to me. The Ganges will become your mother. She will reveal this to you in time. And he turned around and entered the forest, and I never saw him again. In my travels, I studied Christianity, Judaism in Europe. I studied under an Islamic scholar in Mashhad, which
which is a holy place in Iran. I studied with the Dalai Lama's people in Dharamshala of the Himalayas. I studied Burmese meditation under Goenka and Zen Buddhist meditation, and lived with many sages and yogis who worshiped Shiva or were masters in yoga. I was meeting so many people with supernatural powers that it just didn't impress me anymore. People who could sometimes levitate, who could create things just by chanting mantras, who could read minds, who could stop their heartbeat. Among sadhus who are living in those circles, it's not a big thing. But what I was coming to really appreciate was love, was compassion, was to be free of ego and selfishness. That is really a very deep inner perfection. Through my travels and my experiences with so many people, I came to realize that the essence of all these great spiritual paths are so much universal. How to access the love within our heart and be an instrument of compassion within this world. There's a beautiful verse in Bhagavad Gita I learned that really changed my life. When I heard this verse, I thought, this is it. This is what I want. Everything that I went through in my life, this was like the answer. May I tell you? It's an open secret. The Sanskrit is Vidyavanaya Sampane Brahmaniga Vyastini Suni Chaiva Swabhaki Cha Pandita Samadarshana. This is from Bhagavad Gita. That an actual wise person, a person with real knowledge and wisdom, is one who sees everyone with equal vision. Whether one is rich or poor, or black or white, or red or yellow, or brown, or male or female, or Hindu or Muslim, or Christian or Jew, or Buddhist or Jain or Sikh or Zoroastrian or atheist, whether one is a human or an elephant or a cow or a dog or a cat or an insect, wherever there's life, one sees the presence of a part of God. When we see the essence within ourselves, we cannot help but seeing that same essence within all. In the Bible, there's that beautiful commandment to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And if you actually love God with your heart, mind, and soul, then naturally, spontaneously, you have to love your neighbor as yourself. And everyone is our neighbor. We see the connection. We see the relationship. On the physical and mental platform, there's so many differences between us, but on the spiritual platform, we're all of the same essence. And when we recognize that within ourselves, universal love is the natural expression. The body is always changing. We're seeing through our eyes, tasting through our tongue, hearing through our ears, thinking through our brain, loving through our hearts. And the mind is always changing. But who am I? The Bhagavad Gita teaches Najayate Mriyate Vakavichya, that we are that eternal living force that's witnessing through these bodies and minds. And when we understand our own eternal nature through some experience,
then what troubles us so much in this world becomes very insignificant. I remember one of my godbrothers was complaining to my guru, Srila Prabhupada, about the difficulties he was having about in dealing with other people. And he said, you know, within this creation, there are so many universes. And within creation, this universe is just a small part. And within the universe, the Earth planet is just a small part. And within the Earth planet, the city of Los Angeles is just a small part. And within Los Angeles, this house on La Cienega Boulevard is a very small place. And within this house, you're just one little small person. And yet you are thinking the whole world is around you. But when we understand the eternal nature of our own existence, and when we experience the higher pleasure of our own spiritual love, then the things that bother us so much in this world are they're not significant. It's like in a river. On the surface of the river, there may be so many waves affected by the wind, affected by rain. But if you go deep down in the current, it's unaffected by what's going on in the surface. It knows what's happening in the surface. So in life, if our satisfaction, if our conception of reality is based on these external, superficial things that are always changing within this world, then our consciousness is deeply affected by everything that happens. But if we go deeply, where the current of truth is constant, then we can deal with everything that's happening on the surface of life with a clear and compassionate and unselfish, egoless mind, disposition, but not be affected. Because we're finding something so real and so deep and so great within ourselves. And when to the degree we find that, we can appreciate and love every living being. And what greater solution is there in the world than that? Be the change you want to see. Change of heart. When I decided to go to India from Greece, one of the hardest things about that decision was breaking the heart of my mother and father. Because I promised them, they did not want me to go to Europe. That a teenager in the 1960s trying to stop them was not easy. I was supposed to be back for the next semester of college in September. 3 months passed. They didn't hear anything from me. 4 months passed. I knew how much they were worrying, but I didn't know how to explain it to them. And finally, I wrote them a letter. That Gary was no longer with me, that I was hitchhiking to India. And I explained that I have seen how people of the West view life and God. Now I want to see how people of the East view life and God. And what greater education can there be than this? And then I told them something that I knew they would not be able to hear. I said, please do not worry about me. And I wrote that letter. It was postmarked from Iran with no return address. It was difficult. But I did have firm faith. If my motivation was for divine cause, then in the end, they would believe in it. And it would bring them pride and happiness. It took some time. When my mother passed away a few years ago, they had been to India to visit me on three different occasions. My whole family, they all decided unanimously while I was still in India before I came back for her funeral service. They decided we will cremate her body, which has never been done in any of the generations of our family. And we'll give the ashes to Radhanath Swami to bring to India, because she was so proud and so happy with what he was doing there. That meant a lot for me. And with 3,000 of our devotees on the banks of the Ganges River chanting beautiful songs and the prayers of Kirtan, I offered her ashes into the Ganges. And if you remember that sadhu said, the Ganges will be my mother. It was very symbolic. For my spiritual mother and my material mother were merging together. And bhakti, which is the yoga we follow, which I ultimately dedicated my life to the practice of bhakti yoga, the yoga of focusing on awakening this love for the divine, this love for God or for Krishna within the heart, for Ram, and being an instrument of that love. That is what bhakti means. And how bhakti is to harmonize the body, the mind, and the soul, everything, in a spirit of devotion. And how the material and the spiritual are undifferentiated when it's all used in this spirit of devotion. This chanting of God's names, which we have heard, is meant for that purpose of awakening that divinity within us. This morning I was on a radio show, Dennis Miller Show. Have you heard of that? He was really nice person. He was very respectfully making all sorts of jokes. Very beautiful. But can I share one example I gave?
Yes.
That just as Dennis Miller and I were on the radio together, and people who tuned into that frequency were hearing our voices, because they were accessing us. But if you turn the dial to another station, you'll hear the news. You turn it to another station, you may hear classical music, or rock and roll music, or country and western music, or some comedy thing. There's so many different frequencies. And according to what we tune into, then we access that. So similarly, there are innumerable frequencies within the cosmos around us. And what we tune into, we focus into that. And this chanting of mantras, kirtan, meditation of mantras, it's tuning into the divine frequency, which is the spirituality, the essence that is within our hearts, and which is all-pervading everywhere. The presence of God, the love of God. And when we tune into that, and as we chant our mantra, to the degree we really focus and purify ourselves, we get a clear reception. And then we become like broadcasters through our hearts, through our words, through our actions. We become like antennas that are spreading throughout the universe this divine frequency of God's love that is within our hearts. This is what yoga is. To, to ac- access to reconnect us, reunite us with our own essence. In this book, The Journey Home, that I was asked to speak about this evening, is the story of one very small, little, ordinary person who tried to find that. And I thank you so much for being here and listening to the story.
I'm going to share the Dennis Miller part. You're going to share one of the jokes, no? From Dennis Miller from the morning? No?
Well, whatever I was going to share, I could listen to. I don't tell that. He was telling jokes.
Yeah.
Would anyone like to ask any questions? Yes, Shivaji.
Swamiji, thank you so much for coming to Los Angeles and sharing your beauty with us, experience. I had a question that came up for me during your dialogue here about what a beautiful and unique perspective you have from being from and of the West, but immersing yourself for so many years in India, that you really are. It's a very unique perspective. When you come back to the West and see how we are here, maybe I guess if I could phrase in a question, how do you feel one can best be on a path here in the West? My father lives in India for now 10 years, and he does very well there. And when he comes back to America, I see him, triggers old memories and old ways of being that breed suffering for him. And then he goes back to India and he rejoins this connection that, as you were saying, is just, it's everywhere. Everyone you meet, it's in the air, it's in the whole experience. But how could we perhaps in the West find what you've sought for so many years and have found, or learned maybe some skillful methods, ways of being, practices that can help cultivate more of that?
Thank you. Be with people like you. It is important that we make priorities in our life of what we really want and focus on them. Because the nature of this world is we can get so caught up with stuff that we forget what's really important. The nature of materialistic thinking is we value quantity rather than quality. We want quantity of fame, quantity of power, quantity of wealth, quantity of knowledge, and quantity of control. And oftentimes that leaks right into spiritual circles too. And people want to conquer in the name of God rather than to forgive. One great saint I met said that love is everlasting forgiveness. These are virtues. But it's easy to get caught up in stuff. And I've seen, and I'm sure we've all seen, how we can be prisoners of our own success. Where what we work so hard to achieve, we become slaves of that. And it causes us so much anxiety. Well, I think it's very important as human beings that we make our priorities of what really is valuable in life. To a large extent, my parents taught me this when I was just a little boy. My father really struggled. He and my uncle, they invested everything they had and took all these loans to start a business, a this may be before your time, but they were the largest dealers of a particular car in all of Chicagoland. It was called the Edsel. It's the biggest disaster in automobile history. They went into total bankruptcy. Total. They lost everything. He was struggling just to keep the house for us. And he struggled and struggled and worked with such responsibility, and gradually he became quite wealthy after some time. He became more wealthy after I went to India. But even through all of that, I remember my mother, whether she was given a jeweled necklace or just a little flower, it thrilled her equally. And she always told us, it's not the thing that matters, it's the thought that counts. It's the love of the exchange that's all important. All this stuff is only meant to be an expression of the love, but if the love's not there, the stuff means nothing to the heart. And if the love is there, whether you give a person a piece of grass or whether you give them a beautiful house, it's the same. And I remember my father, he'd be working sometimes 15, 16, 17 hours a day trying to get out of his bankruptcy. And when he'd come home, he would say, money isn't very important. He would say, the real important is the love we have for each other. And they meant it. And when we focus that love on the eternal love of the soul, spiritual love, love beyond the birth and deaths of these bodies, then it's infinitely more deeper, the relationships. So it's very important that we establish priorities, what we really want in life, and then to use our good human intelligence to balance and harmonize all of our responsibilities in a way that we'll be moving forward toward our goal. So we may have responsibilities to our occupation, to our families, but we also have our spiritual responsibilities to purify our own heart, to do these other things as an expression of the wealth that's within us, rather than just trying to get stuff from outside to bring happiness within, which we can't really do, to actually find the happiness within and express it through the things that we do. And when we make that priority, then several things are important. One is satsang, to associate with people who are like-minded, who we can enlighten and they can enlighten us, who share that same purpose. It's important to keep us focused when there's so many distractions all around us, is to spend quality time with people of like minds, and with saintly people. And two is to put some time a day for our spiritual practice. In my own tradition, we chant this Hare Krishna mantra and beads for a couple hours every day. It's a meditation. Some people do it for a few minutes. With Swamis, we do it a few hours. But it grounds us. It's like a foundation. This building that we're in now, the Bodhi Tree Bookstore, it's a very beautiful bookstore. People may come in and say it's beautiful architecture, such beautiful decorations, wonderful paintings, wonderful books. But how many people come into your bookstore and say, you have a fantastic foundation? Foundation isn't seen by the eyes, but it holds up everything else. In the Bible it said, if you build your house on shifting sand, then when the storm comes, it all tumbles down. You build it on solid rock, and no storm can disturb it. Similarly, we're so much subject to stress and depression and flickering moods and everything else. If we don't have a strong spiritual foundation, But many people, they don't see it as a priority because it's not something that you tangibly see results. Like if you work, you get money. If you work out, you get strength and beauty, which are good, but it's also important. While we're doing that we keep a very strong spiritual foundation, and that means by setting some time aside for our meditation, for our chanting. In early mornings, excellent. It could be done any time of the day, but early morning is a very excellent time for that. So to put serious spiritual time as a priority every day for our spiritual practice, balance and harmonize that with all of our other responsibilities, to keep good satsang, associate with people who really encourage us, and third of all, to really strive to live with good character. Because if there's anything that demoralizes people towards spirituality, it's people who speak but do something different. People who, in the name of love, they hate. Real spirituality is the art of transformation. Transformation of character. From arrogance to humility. From greed to generosity. From hate to love. From selfishness to selflessness. From a desire to exploit to a desire to serve. From anxiety to peace. To be instruments of compassion. From vengeance to forgiveness. And to really strive to live by this type of character. And develop a foundation for that character to be built upon by our spiritual practice and by the association we keep. It's not only possible, but it's for sure if we just endeavor with sincerity. There's a beautiful story of Hanuman. Do you all know Hanuman? He was the divine monkey devotee of Sri Ram. And he was helping to build a bridge across the Indian Ocean. In fact, in December, we're going on a pilgrimage to that very place where he built the bridge. It's called Rameshwaram. Have any of you been there? We're bringing, how many are scheduled to come? There's already registered 5,000. 5,000 people registered already. And we're going to 100 buses going from place to place. But we're going to that place where the bridge was built. And we read in Ramayana, Hanuman was so strong. And his strength was not due to muscles, wasn't due to bodybuilding. His strength was due to his devotion. For he had such an enthusiasm to serve Ram, to please Ram, that there was just nothing impossible. Whatever Ram needed, he just had such a desire, such an enthusiasm. He was empowered by the Lord because of his surrender. When we actually take shelter of the divine, we become empowered by the divine to do things way beyond our own abilities. When we just do the best we can and do what we can, that's all right. But it's not near as fun as when we feel a divine power way beyond our own, using us as instruments to do their will. That's really ecstatic experience. So Hanuman was lifting mountains. He was uprooting, he would tear off the top of a mountain, which may be miles wide, and he was carrying that and putting it in the ocean. He would draw the name of Ram on it, and it would float. He was bringing this huge mountaintop, and as he was walking, there was a little spider. And this little spider with one of his legs, tiny little skinny leg, was trying to kick some sand to do his part in building the bridge. And Hanuman honored and recognized that little spider, that he is doing as much as me. Because from Lord Ram's eyes, from the Lord's eyes, doesn't see what we do. He sees our intention. Bhavagrahi. The Lord is one who sees our intention. And that little spider was doing everything within his power, and Hanuman was doing everything within his power. So from the perspective of God or Ram, they were absolutely the same. And Hanuman stood aside and honored that spider. He didn't say, look at me, what I'm doing, look at you. He honored, you are doing as much as me, maybe more, because you're doing everything you can. So whoever we are, there's no disqualification. There are beautiful stories of illiterate people who were the greatest saints. There's stories of kings and poor people, scholars and illiterate people, spiders and divine monkeys. It doesn't matter what our past is. It doesn't matter what our particular status may be. All that matters is our sincerity. Because through that sincerity we can access the divinity, we can tune into that frequency. So if we make that a priority, then nothing can stop us from making spiritual progress. But that's the beginning. Because if we don't make it a priority, it's for sure that we'll be diverted all over the place. Is there any other question? Yes. Is there a time we should end? Soon. You are so polite. That means now. That's a very gracious way of saying now. But one more question.
Do you have any advice for modern day pilgrims?
Don't give up the pilgrimage. Yes, life is a pilgrimage. Life is a journey home. The journey home is not the journey to India or to Jerusalem or to Mecca. Our real home is within our heart. These places could help us find. But the real journey home is within the heart, because that's where we'll find the love of God. And that's where we'll find our real relationship with all other living beings, our real family. That's where we'll find real comfort, real joy, real connection. And human life is a pilgrimage to find ourselves. In Sanskrit, the word Krishna means all attractive, the reservoir of all beauty, of all sweetness, of all pleasure. Everything that we're looking for in a loving relationship is there, dormant within us. That's where we find our real home. Thank you very much. You bring our hearts right into our souls. anyone would like to read this book, I'll be very grateful. I can sign it, I'll be very grateful.
Did Gary go to Israel?
He did go to Israel.
Oh, I needed to know. Did he find something there that he was directed to do?
That's all in the book.
Oh, it's in there?
It's an amazing story. I tell you, it's more than that. What's your name?
Robin.
Oh, I hope so. I can, I have a pen. Here you go.
Okay.
A special color, too.
Nishi.
Nishi. N-I-S-H-I.